The headlines: explosions are reported in Kiev and several major Ukrainian cities as Ukraine says Russia has launched a massive air raid in several ways. The Syrian defense minister and intelligence chief hold talks with their Turkish counterparts in Moscow, the first such meeting in years. And also, in our headlines, the U.S. State Department approves the potential sale of anti-tank systems to Taiwan, despite China's opposition to such arms sales to the self-ruled island. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half-hour: authorities in Ukraine say Russia has unleashed heavy missile strikes on several parts of the country, including the capital, Kiev. A Ukrainian presidential advisor says Moscow has fired more than 100 missiles in its latest attacks. The projectiles have reportedly hit areas across Ukraine, including the regions of Mykolaiv and Odessa in the south. The mayor of Lviv has also said that the strikes have knocked out electricity in most parts of the West Ukrainian city. Russia's newest attacks come after it refused to accept a peace plan Kiev has been promoting since last month. The so-called 10-point peace formula includes an item which requires Moscow to give up the four regions it annexed in September. The Kremlin says Ukraine must accept that the regions of Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson are now part of Russia. The Italian government is framing a clampdown on NGO asylum seeker rescue ships, as humanitarian groups have warned that the move will stop them from saving lives at sea. Italy's interior ministry said the measure will halt organized campaigns to bring asylum seekers departing from Libya and other countries to Italy.
Italy's far-right government is about to adopt a security decree that will introduce a compulsory code of conduct for NGO-run ships rescuing asylum seekers in the Mediterranean Sea. Since day one of its mandate, the Giorgia Meloni government has pledged to press ahead with an agenda aimed at stopping what it calls irregular migration. The new measures will force NGO-run ships to deliver rescued asylum seekers to port immediately, without waiting to pick up more people at sea or transferring asylum seekers to larger vessels. Under the new rules, rescued people will also have to apply for asylum in the country where the NGO-run ship is flagged in. Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Piantedosi has said the new provisions aim to prevent organized campaigns to transport asylum seekers departing from Libya and other countries to Italy.
We asked if the migrant issue would be the main focus of the next year's opening council of the EU ministers' meeting. The EU needs a serious and constructive approach on the matter in order to draw a clear distinction between asylum seekers and irregular migrants.
According to the Italian government, saving lives at sea has contributed to increasing migration, and while some NGO ships genuinely carry out rescues, others engage, quote, in systematic searches for people in cahoots with migrant traffickers. Humanitarian groups have warned that the government's measures will stop them from saving lives. Over 90,000 people have arrived at Italy's ports this year. Rome has been stopping many NGO-run ships from docking in the country, on one occasion sparking a diplomatic rift with France after an NGO-run vessel flying the French flag was denied entry. Italy's policies on the migrant issue have been strongly condemned over the years. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal authorizes Italy and the EU to help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence and abuse are practiced. That deal today is still in place. Max Civilli, Rome.
The Syrian defense minister and intelligence chief have met with their Turkish counterparts in Moscow in the presence of Russian officials. This is according to Syria's official media. The Syrian media also reported that the two sides discussed several issues of bilateral interest to both countries. The Turkish defense ministry also confirmed The report describing it as a clear sign of normalization between Ankara and Damascus. The Turkish ministry added that Russia's defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, was also present in the meeting. The crisis in Syria, the Syrian refugees, and the fight against terrorism were major topics of discussion. The participants agreed to continue trilateral meetings. Earlier this month, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he had proposed to his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin to work out a trilateral mechanism to accelerate diplomacy between Ankara and Damascus. Journalist Dmitry Zolotarev joined us earlier from Irkutsk with his take on the significance of the relationship between Turkey, Syria, and Russia.
The relationship between the three countries, Ankara, Syria, and Russia, are improving even more. I think that's in light of the perspective of Ankara to be a gas and resources hub for the southern Europe. You know, still Italy is still getting the Russian resources through Turkey, unlike Germany and other European countries. So Ankara lets know the rest of the world that where its alliance lies. So this is a good sign. This is a good sign for Russia. This is a good sign for Bashar Assad also. And this is a good sign for Syria, for Turkey, I'm sorry, because three countries, Russia, Syria, and Turkey, are better players in the region than the United States, which still has its appetites in Turkey, I'm sorry, in Syria. So I see maybe in the future three countries will consider pushing out the United States from the region, which is really good for the region, basically.
Israel is stepping up its anti-Iran rhetoric by once again threatening the Islamic Republic with military action against its nuclear sites. Israel's Minister of Military Affairs says Tel Aviv could attack Iranian facilities in 2 or 3 years. Benny Gantz, in a speech, told Air Force cadets they would participate in such attacks. Israel has been issuing veiled military threats against Iran for more than a decade. Tehran has repeatedly warned that any Israeli provocation will not go unanswered. Israeli threats against Iran come as the regime's Western backers remain silent over Tel Aviv's own nuclear activities. Unlike Iran, Israel is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that allows the UN nuclear watchdog's access to civil nuclear technologies. Israel is believed to possess up to 400 nuclear warheads. Iran has repeatedly said that all of its nuclear activities are for peaceful purposes. The UN agency has in the past verified the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear programs. Political analyst Sayed Mohammad Marandi says Israel will be highly vulnerable to counter-drone and missile attacks by Iran.
They are nothing new. The Israeli regime has been making similar threats for many years now. But the fact is that Iran's defense capabilities, its air defense capabilities, are highly improved. And also, Iran's peaceful nuclear program is very well protected. All of the key sites are underground to protect them from any such aggression, whether it's the Israeli regime or the United States. But more importantly is the fact that if the regime makes such a major mistake, the Iranian response would be through its drone and missile systems, and they would devastate the regime. We have to keep in mind that Palestine is a small piece of territory, and it's easy for Iran to devastate the infrastructure across that region very easily with thousands of drones and missiles. And it would be the Israeli regime that's blamed by the international community for initiating aggression that would lead to such a heavy-handed Iranian response.
Lebanon's economic and financial crisis remains intact while the political elite have failed to implement reforms or even elect a new president. Some analysts, however, believe there's still hope that the materialization of the natural resources extraction could somehow bring the country out of the current economic impasse. Mayim Saleh reports from Beirut.
Lebanon's economic meltdown is about to enter its fourth year, with additional afflictions in its trail. Although the country could finally hold the much-awaited parliamentary elections, it entered the trap of a presidential election stalemate.
With the mindset and the mentality of many of the Lebanese politicians, I think it's a very difficult process. You mentioned the Lebanese forces. It's known the Lebanese forces have this blind hatred and ideological demonization of other parties, first and foremost Hezbollah. This facilitates the intervention of foreign parties like Saudi Arabia, who are said to put a veto on certain presidential candidates.
The year 2022 was not all towards a downfall for Lebanon. The year marked the finalization of a maritime border deal signed by Lebanon and Israel after more than a decade of on-off indirect talks. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. He also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue.
What happened in Nakara is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
Analysts believe Hezbollah made the right calculations in this move.
What stood out for me was the pragmatism exercised by Hezbollah in this particular agreement. It was very pragmatic in its approach, focusing, I think, first and foremost on Lebanon's economic interests, particularly with the dire economic situation. I think it was also a smart game played by Hezbollah, because I think that they believed deep down there was a conviction by the leadership that Biden couldn't afford another war and would prevent Israel from launching a war, even if Israel had a wish.
The deal is also seen as one of the major achievements of former President Michel Aoun, who stepped down in November without a successor. Now, while Lebanese lawmakers have so far failed to elect a new president, a caretaker cabinet remains in place since the parliamentary vote last spring, showing no sign of efforts to implement economic reforms. As Lebanon ends the year 2022 without a president, observers are skeptical that any achievement concerning this file can be achieved soon. However, many believe that prospects for gas production and export are promising in the new year. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Stocks in the Asia-Pacific region plunge as investors remain concerned about the impact of a spike in COVID cases in China, the world's second-largest economy. Japan's Nikkei was down 1.3% in the early trading. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index shed 1%. Markets in Sydney, Singapore, Shanghai, Taipei, and Seoul were also in the red. The losses followed sharp falls on Wall Street, where three main indexes tumbled on Wednesday, with NASDAQ losing 1.4%. Stockholders were seen happy over China's zero COVID controls, but they are now worried that a new pandemic wave could impact supply chains. Worries of a looming recession in some economies amid rising inflation have also cast shadow on global stocks in recent weeks. That forced the U.S. Federal Reserve to hike interest rates again. The European Central Bank and the Bank of England also made similar moves. The U.S. State Department has approved the potential sale of anti-tank systems to Taiwan, a move which is likely to anger China. The Pentagon says anti-tank mine-laying systems are likely to be sold to Taiwan for an estimated $180 million. Taiwan's defense ministry said in a statement that the sale would take effect in about a month. It said continuous U.S. military sales are, quote, the cornerstone of maintaining regional stability and peace. The potential deal comes as Taiwan claims it is under increasing pressure from China, citing frequent Chinese air drills near the island. China considers a self-ruled Taiwan as its own territory and vows to take the island by force if necessary. Washington is Taiwan's strongest international backer and main supplier of arms. And a newly elected Republican lawmaker in the U.S. House of Representatives is under criminal investigation for lying about his resume. Media cited prosecutors as saying that there are numerous fabrications and inconsistencies associated with George Santos. His victory in the Empire State helped Republicans secure a narrow majority in the House, but a New York Times investigation cast doubt on parts of Santos' education and work history. On Monday, the lawmaker himself admitted to significant fabrications of his resume, confessing that he neither worked for Citigroup and Goldman Sachs, nor graduated from any college or university. Despite the revelation, Santos refuses to give up his seat, but Democrats are calling for his expulsion. Santos first ran for Congress in 2020, but lost. He won in the recent midterm elections from the district that includes some Long Island suburbs and a small part of Queens. Well, in Bolivia, protesters have flocked to the streets of main cities to demand the release of opposition leader Luis Fernando Camacho. Demonstrators blocked the streets and torched the prosecutor's office in Santa Cruz, the country's commercial hub. They also gathered at the city's two airports to stop Camacho's transfer to the capital, La Paz. The prominent opposition leader, who also serves as Santa Cruz's governor, was detained on Wednesday. The public prosecutor's office said Camacho was arrested on charges of terrorism and his attempts to oust the president. In 2019, Camacho's office, however, says the governor was kidnapped in a completely irregular police operation. His supporters reiterate the same allegations, promising that they won't back down until he's set free. This year, the Bolivian government arrested a number of prominent figures in connection with the 2019 ouster of then-president Evo Morales. One of them is ex-president Jeanine Añez, who replaced Morales and served until 2020. She was accused of orchestrating a coup and was eventually sentenced to 10 years in prison. In July, the Bolivian government believes that a coup had caused Morales to tender his resignation. He stepped down after winning a controversial fourth term in office.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
School of Soleimani. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As we approach the anniversary of martyrdom of the great anti-terror general and commander of hearts, Qasem Soleimani, we have prepared a five-part series to commemorate this unmatched general. Stay tuned, please. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on the personality of Haj Qasem Soleimani, "Let us not look at the dear martyr, Haj Qasem Soleimani, as an individual. Let us look at him as a course, a path, and a school that teaches lessons." Qasem Soleimani was the great commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, who was martyred on January 3rd, 2020, through a drone attack near Baghdad Airport by the American Terrorist Army. Qasem Soleimani was born in Qanat Malik village of Rabur city of Kerman province. He writes in his autobiography, "I was born in 1956. I caught syphilis in a very cold winter. My parents had no hope in my healing. They tested every local medicine, but there was no use in them. According to my father, my mother wrapped me on her back while there was a heavy snow up to the knees and set out for a physician in Rabur. Anyway, after a while, I survived through God's will." Like all villages in Iran, Qanat Malik was very poor during the Pahlavi regime. Therefore, Qasem Soleimani had to leave it for the city at the age of 14. He writes in his autobiography, "My father's debt to the rural bank had made me more concerned than my mother. I cried several times out of the fear of my father's imprisonment. I decided to go to the city to pay my father's debt at any cost. My parents were opposed to me. I was just 14, a weak boy who had only seen Rabur city. His first experience was to work as a worker in a half-constructed building. He continues, "I worked for 6 days from sunrise till near sunset in front of a half-constructed building. My feeble body and young age could not tolerate such a job. My little hands would bleed." His income was low and it would take a long time to pay back his father's debt. So he started working at a hotel. He was working at a fruit juice shop too. Finally, he paid back his father's debt after 5 months. Young Qasem Soleimani was not scared of city anymore. He enrolled at a Zurkhane, a gym where traditional Iranian sport is practiced and taught. He also attended karate classes and got green belt in it. Soleimani writes, "Sport had a great effect on my religious morals and was one of the factors to prevent me from going to immoralities in spite of being young. Bastani sport played a special role in this regard, as it is originated in moral and religious principles." In 1974, he heard a word against the Shah for the first time. While the son of his boss at hotel was speaking of the Shah centers of immorality, one of Qasem's relatives spoke of his oppression and injustice. Martyr Soleimani writes, "I noticed that Bahram was speaking like Ali Yazdan Panah, but not of the Shah's corruption, rather of his oppression as people are detained, imprisoned, and killed. The Shah does not allow any gathering be held for Imam Hussein's mourning. As I had grown up with the mourning ceremony of Imam Hussein since my childhood, I said loudly, 'Damn him!' As I told this, Bahram was pale and said out of horror, 'Do you want to be detained?'" 2 years later, Qasem Soleimani started going to a mosque to learn the exegesis of the Quran. This shaped up his religious character little by little. The Shah's regime had set up bars and discos in provincial centers to corrupt youth, but it was not successful in Kerman. In the summer of 1976, there was held a feast by singers and dancers in the city. Young Qasem and two of his friends showed their opposition and anger through puncturing the tires of their cars.
Thank you.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani continues in his autobiography, "As a teenager, I would fight immorality with honor, and I feared no one. However, I had no clear information on SAVAK, the Shah's intelligence and security apparatus. I had just heard its name several times, but I was not afraid of anything." Elsewhere, Martyr Soleimani writes, "It was the Muharram month of 1976. I was looking out of the hotel window. Opposite the hotel was the municipality and police office of Kerman. A young girl was walking on the pavement. A police officer disturbed her. The act was very upsetting for me on the day of Ashura, so I decided to confront him regardless of the consequences." Young Qasem rushed to the street and knocked down the cop with karate moves. The cop hooted his whistle and two other cops ran toward him. Qasem ran to the hotel and hid under a bed. A number of cops looked for him but couldn't find him. On his trip to the holy city of Mashhad, Qasem Soleimani heard the name of Imam Khomeini from two young boys for the first time. As the anti-regime demonstrations escalated in the city of Qom and also in the city of Tabriz in 1978, the city of Kerman changed totally as well. The chants of death to the Shah could be heard here and there. As a brave youth, Qasem Soleimani would write "Death to the Shah" and "Greetings to Khomeini" on the walls of city. He writes in his autobiography, "I would look at Imam Khomeini's picture several times every day, as if he was by me and I was reading the Quran beside him. He was a part of me." That was the first episode of the 5-part special series on Martyr Soleimani. Tomorrow, we will continue with the second part. The second part will be on his role in the 8-year imposed war.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a controversial Title 42 border policy. But what is a Title 42 policy in the first place, and why is it important? For starters, it uses public health as a justification for expelling asylum seekers. But is that justified under the norms of human rights, especially when it comes to asylum seekers and international law? And why have rights groups characterized it as arbitrary and illegal? In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at the controversy surrounding not only this Title 42 provision, but whether the issue of asylum seekers, which has been a problem for the U.S., has its roots in maybe U.S. foreign policy. Let's find those questions and a lot more from our guests. Let me introduce them. Barbara Petillo joins us. He's a political activist and attorney from Washington, D.C. Also joining us, David K. Johnson, investigative journalist and author, who joins us from Rochester, New York. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Barbara Petillo, I'll start first with you, and of course, given the name, maybe some are not aware what it is, I included, and you can explain to us what it is, and why is it that it's been used by the current and previous U.S. administrations, which appears on the surface anyways, in order to expel either migrants or asylum seekers?
Well, the United States has had an issue with immigration dating back 40 years. The last time we had any major efforts to ameliorate the problem was Ronald Reagan back in 1986, when he granted what many call amnesty to all of the, or to a large number of migrants who were currently in the country at that time. Since then, America has kicked the can down the road on what's called comprehensive immigration reform. This will be reforming our border, instituting border security, creating a pathway to citizenship, dealing with our guest worker program, modernizing our H-1B visa program to bring high-skilled laborers over, in addition to dealing with DACA. Those are children who were brought to this country as infants who grew up here but do not have citizenship standards. Concurrent with this, during the beginning parts of the pandemic, the Trump administration, because they had not been able to pass comprehensive immigration reform in 2018, instituted this policy, Title 42, which allows the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Naturalization Services to deport migrants and asylum seekers without going through the normal process of claiming asylum, having a hearing under international law, under the pandemic emergency. Since then, almost all the pandemic emergency powers have been repealed, be that masking in public, vaccine mandates, separation, those sorts of things, but Title 42 remains in place. The Biden administration has sought to allow Title 42 to expire in order to return to the traditional method within the context of international law for asylum seekers. However, the Supreme Court has overruled him on that.
I was trying to keep up with all the fact that you were giving me. I think I gave up halfway through it. I do apologize for that. But before I go to David K. Johnston, what I want to find out from you, did what Trump do in terms of this Title 42 something that was legal in the way that he presented it and came up with this in terms of wanting to reach his goal of not letting people in the U.S., whether they're asylum seekers or migrants?
Well, presidents are normally granted special emergency powers during national emergencies. President Trump used the excuse of the coronavirus pandemic to institute Title 42 towards his broader gain, broader goal of reducing immigration from Central and South America. However, that was supposed to expire when the emergency was over. What the courts have done, because we have a 6-3 conservative majority on the court, they have overruled the president, they have overruled the Congress, and basically, according to Justice Gorsuch, made them as the arbiter of U.S. immigration law, which is outside the constitutional bounds of what the court is supposed to do.
Okay, thank you for that. All right, David K. Johnston, what do you think? Tell us maybe in a bit simpler terms as to what you think about this, but overall, what's the crisis and controversy about here?
Well, first of all, everything Robert Petillo told you is right on the money, so let me give a little broader context to this. There is, in the history of the world, no wealthy country bordering or near a poor country or countries that has kept people from coming in. Human beings who get up and leave tend also to be the people who have the most gumption and accomplish something. And U.S. foreign policy is right at the heart of this. In Honduras, where many of the people coming to the U.S. southern border come from, a country I have visited 3 times in this century, I'm not surprised people are leaving. 12-year-old girls are being pressed into prostitution by criminal gangs. Young boys are being forced into joining these gangs and committing crimes. Tegucigalpa, the capital, is the most dangerous city in the Western Hemisphere. And so, of course, there are people who are going to either send their children or take their children in an effort to get asylum. And under American law, They have an absolute right to appear at a proper border station and seek asylum. The problem is, as Robert Petillo pointed out, since Ronald Reagan's version of an amnesty, there has been nothing serious done by Congress. And Donald Trump, who began his campaign for president with a racist tirade against Mexicans, calling them murderers and rapists, used 42 in an effort to stop any immigration. It had nothing to do with the law. It had to do with his racist policies. So now you have pent-up demand of people who want to come. And that is creating a real and serious problem, one that could be addressed by better U.S. government policies, both at the border and in foreign policy.
So let's play out the scenario here on the humanitarian side, which needs to be addressed, Robert Petillo. And I'm wondering what you think about it when you have these people who are fleeing. We're going to get to some of the reasons why they may be fleeing their homeland. But they're fleeing where they're coming from, making that dangerous journey, which is dangerous within itself, making that journey, then getting to the border area perhaps. And then over there, they want to obviously get into, in this case, the U.S. But then they're facing a whole raft of other dangers, where when you take a look at some of the records of what has happened to them, shocking instances of sexual and physical abuse is what I'm reading. You have instances of rape, in some cases murder, that have happened. And in the case of sexual and physical abuse, I'm reading the U.S. border and federal officers have been involved in that. Is there no monitoring of this to happen when they get there, that we're seeing these instances?
I think me and David were going to agree that there's little to no monitoring. And part of the issue is that when you create this illicit system, as we have currently, instead of being able to simply follow the international law, present yourself and enter the country under asylum, because most of you people are seeking asylum because of U.S. government policy. Let's not forget that. Because of the war on drugs, because of the banana republic wars that the U.S. launched, because of our propensity for replacing democratically elected leadership with U.S. puppet governments, that's why these people are fleeing those countries. But because we do not have a proper system in place, that creates coyotes who are human smugglers who are able to take these people from their homes. They sell all of their property and belongings to give their children a chance for a better life, and often do not make it there. If the America does not reform this system, they have no moral authority to stand up and look at China or any other nation and say that they need to reform their human rights laws. All they've done is push it across the border so they don't have to look at it and see the results of what their policies have been.
All right. Our guest there, David K. Johnson, talked about some of the reasons perhaps that the U.S. May be at fault here, if you agree with them. And if you can give us some examples of some of the countries that perhaps, due to U.S. foreign policy or otherwise, has impacted the lives, and I'm guessing it's mostly economically driven, that they feel that they have to leave the country unless it's for safety and security concerns.
Well, what's happened in Honduras, which is where many of the people at the border are coming from, has been the long-term support of governments that have been unsuccessful in dealing with crime, have been quite corrupted by the drug traffic. But, you know, the U.S. is a place people want to come to, and we are indeed mishandling this at the border. But imagine if something happens in Pakistan, Afghanistan, or Azerbaijan, and floods of people want to get into Iran. Is there any reason to believe that your country would do better at this than we're doing? I mean, these are problems that we see pop up around the world. The Australians are having problems with this, is an excellent example. And part of their solution has been to take people and put them on the islands off the Northern Territories. So, but much as the U.S. is not handling this well, I think we need to see it in a global context.
This global context is very important because here, as our guest there said, Robert Padillo, Iran has been on the receiving end of many Afghans, especially after the shoddy, to say the least, U.S. withdrawal of the occupation of that country, where we really had an uptick in the volume of Afghan refugees, asylum seekers, whatever name you would like to put on it, that came and flowed into Iran. And we did our best, and we still continue to do that. So we know exactly how that feels. But when it comes to this issue, to put it in the world context, where in the what parts of the world is there this flow or problem where there's not it's not a result of a foreign policy of another country? I mentioned the U.S. because not to just pinpoint the U.S. because the U.S. is involved in so many different excursions, if you want to call it, around the world, whether it's through itself covertly, indirectly, or with its allies, that has resulted in that. Maybe you can expand a little bit more for us, whatever examples that comes to your mind. Robert Padilla.
Yeah, I think a perfect example will be countries that are affected by narco-terrorism. These drug cartels are primarily being financed by the American drug habit. 50% of the cocaine in the world is consumed in the United States of America, the good old U.S. of A. And this gives substantial power to the drug cartels, to FARC and other groups that are able to overthrow governments, that are able to bring down the ruling classes and replace them with simply narco government officials who have to buy in for protection. You look at a nation like Venezuela, which was a prosperous nation 20 years ago, but after the failed coup attempt by President Trump when he attempted to replace President Maduro with Juan Guaido, we saw massive waves of migrants leaving Venezuela to try to come to the United States. And then when they get there, the very same political instability that was caused by Trump, they are met with Trump's Title 42 border policy. You can go all the way through the 1980s, the U.S. Great Invasion of Grenada, their intervention in Panama. You can go back to the Banana Republic Wars when Chiquita Banana was able to basically overthrow governments in Central America. All of these things are part of the American sphere of hegemonic influence. And because of that, there is a responsibility, even beyond that, which is articulated in international law, to take in these migrants. Not to mention these individuals are a net positive to the U.S. economy. Nobody's walking 1,000 miles through the
Good
desert
point.
To come get on social services.
That's a great point, which I want to ask you, David K. Johnson. Whether it's the U.S., of people trying to get into the U.S., or whether it's Europe, much of the people who actually do make it inside the country are involved in the part of the economy that many people of those countries perhaps are not interested in or cannot fill those positions. So they do serve a purpose. Maybe that's something that you could expand on it for us, if you agree with that.
Almost everyone in the United States came here, or their ancestors came here from somewhere else. Mine came in mostly in the late 1800s. And immigrants who arrive with no skills are denounced by the far right in America. But what the research shows is that they are very hard workers. They push their children to be well educated. And by the second, or at the latest, the third generation, almost without exception, they are prosperous. So absolutely, we would be better off if we had a more open policy about immigration. Canada has done very well with its immigration policies. Now, those policies change the nature of who the population is, the demographics of the population, and the people who are white supremacists, the Trumpers, they don't like that. They only want Western and Northern Europeans being allowed to immigrate to the United States. And the world just doesn't work that way.
Okay, great point. Another great point. So, Robert Padilla, let's expand on that. How much of the U.S. population actually feels that way? We know Trump obviously highlighted that, whether he wanted or not, or whether that was just a reflection of his personality, of the type of people that the U.S. should be composed of in terms of, let's say, whoever wants to enter. But is there that kind of a discrimination when it comes to the types of people who want asylum in the U.S. who then obviously want to be employed in the workforce?
Yes, there is. I'll give you an example that when Russia invaded Ukraine, they announced that 100,000 Ukrainian migrants would be coming to America to seek asylum from the war there, and there was absolutely no outrage. You did not hear the political right, saying that they are coming to change your way of life, this, that, and the other, because they are completely fine with European migrants coming here to seek asylum. During the Trump administration, they said, well, why can't we get more people from Norway and the Netherlands to come to the United States of America? And this is not a strictly America problem. Giorgia Meloni, the new prime minister in Italy, she does not want African migrants coming to Italy. She says she wants Venezuelan migrants who have lighter skin and who come from a Latin background, who speak a similar language, speaking Spanish versus Italian, and since they can incorporate into the society better there. This has been the policy of the United States of America since the 1800s. Since the Mexican-American War, there was an opportunity for America to annex the entirety of Mexico, but they decided not to do so because they did not want to change changing racial composition of America to being a majority Latino nation. And this remains the part of American foreign policy, is the unspoken part, where the reason that this is an issue is that if this was migration coming from Canada to America, it wouldn't be a problem. The fact that it's black and brown people descended from slavery who are coming to this country, that is why this suddenly becomes an issue.
All right, and we know that this, as our guest from Washington, Robert Padilla, indicated, David K. Johnson, has been a problem that it seems like it's been kicked down the road by different U.S. presidents who have come into power. Why has there not been, first of all, a solution that has been effective? Is there one? And or are we seeing this being used as a basis for political maneuvering when it comes to, for example, wanting to have some popularity amongst the general population, an issue that perhaps is used that way?
Well, except for Donald Trump, American presidents actually have tried to get solutions. The problem is in Congress. We have a deeply divided Congress. There's a joke in Washington where back before Ronald Reagan, Democrats and Republicans would jointly rent a house or an apartment and live together. And today the joke is that a Democrat and Republican riding in a taxi together is a major act of bipartisanship. So the core of this is the inability to get enough members of Congress on one side or the other politically to move forward. The solutions to this are multiple. One of them, obviously, is changes in U.S. foreign policy. Not doing things like overthrowing governments as the U.S. did 70 years ago in your country, and installing regimes that American non-elected leaders think would be better for U.S. interests. That's an important one. It's especially true in Central America, where many of the people at the southern border are coming from, not Mexico, but south of Mexico. Secondly, we have to address the drug trafficking. So long as drugs are illegal, we're going to continue to have this problem. Drug prices are falling, which tells you the war on drugs doesn't work. And we need to decide we're going to take our losses in a different way, not by corrupting law enforcement and courts, but by instead, and foreign governments, but by instead accepting that some people are going to be drug abusers and they're going to suffer the consequences. That would reduce the power of these criminal cartels in a number of countries outside the U.S. And then we need to have an adequately staffed and system for allowing asylum seekers to come in to have their claims heard, and if they qualify, to let them into the country, and if they don't, to send them back. But we don't fund this in an adequate way, and again, Congress controls funding. The real core of the problem here is Congress, particularly the far right racist elements in the U.S. Congress, who want to make America white again. And I'm playing a little on Donald Trump's make it great again.
Okay. All right. Taking a look at the U.S. President Joe Biden, Robert Padilla, where does it stand with him in terms of, we know that he wanted to, for example, he wanted to end Title 42 in the spring of 2022, from what we understand, because he felt like, you know, at this point, the pandemic is on the wane, which could now be turning a direction, but putting that aside, is he somebody that you see that can help the situation, enact anything that perhaps can improve the conditions, especially at the border in terms of that aspect of it, but on a larger scale, whether it can do anything to stop the people from making that move in the first place? I think that would require Biden to talk with the leaders of the other country, like maybe Obrador in Mexico, to see what it can be done. And I think he has, but we're not seeing the major improvement that is required, have we?
Well, no, and I think if Biden was going to do something major on immigration, would have had to be done last year. In January of next year, we're going to get a Republican House of Representatives, a Republican Speaker of the House, and they will have absolutely zero appetite to have comprehensive immigration reform. At the same time, President Biden is now confronted by a 6-3 majority for conservatives on the Supreme Court. For the last several decades, they've been maneuvering to take that institution over, and they have shown that they have no problem problem being an activist court overruling the President of the United States, overruling Congress when it comes to our immigration policy. So if even if he instituted executive action on immigration, it would more than likely be overruled by the court the same way that we've seen the student loan reform be held up and many other executive actions. So there's very little that President Biden can actually do with regards to immigration in the short term. What they can do is take the current law and the current criteria that we have and try to staff up on federal judges, try to bring in more immigration attorneys, provide more resources from the federal government to handle the current influx, put a real investment into it. The fact that America can spend $850 billion, which is the new defense authorization in the latest budget, $850 billion on national defense, but cannot allocate proper resources to the border to have a humane and just immigration system is beyond comprehension. I think the Biden administration has to use whatever tools are available to ensure that we are streamlining the system as much as possible.
And final question to you, which is a general one, David K. Johnson. Where do we go from here in terms of what's going to happen? I have a feeling that we're going to continue seeing these migrants and asylum seekers, not just coming, trying to come into the U.S., but from other, from Mexico, but from other, obviously, countries who will strive to get into the U.S. mainland.
Well, as Robert Perdillo pointed out, nothing will happen in the next 2 years that will be beneficial. There may be some very damaging things that will happen in terms of ginned up hearings about phony issues, but nothing towards resolving these issues will occur for the next 2 years. At core, the American people have to make a fundamental decision about where they want to go, what direction they want the country to go, and that'll be reflected in who is elected to Congress. And of course, in America, over the last 30 years or so, Republicans have made a really determined effort to create what are called gerrymandered districts that essentially guarantee Republicans re-election. And we end up with situations like Pennsylvania having two-thirds of its residents Democrats, but two-thirds of its congressional delegation Republicans, so it's not representative. In foreign policy, there we may see some advances. Biden has on several fronts done some remarkable things that are beneficial. And I think we'll see some executive actions, but nothing from Congress.
All right. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it. Thank you so much. David K. Johnson, investigative journalist and author from Rochester, New York. Robert Petillo, thank you. Political activist and attorney from Washington, D.C. Season's greetings to both of you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batavwe and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ربنا
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 of As-Sahifah As-Sajjadiyah for Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn Zainul Abidin, and we go to the point where the Imam says, وَتَعَاطُ الْكُلْفَ. We said, the Imam trying to say, don't put yourself or don't undertake problems and troubles or duties more than what you require. And we were saying in the previous episode that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even when it comes to the human beings, He doesn't require them to put themselves in harm's way or to overburden themselves with things, even in His sake. So we mentioned a hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam where he tells Amir al-Mu'mineen that even when it comes to religion, try to take it easy. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi also in a wasiyah to al-Harith al-Hamadani, one of his companions, he says, وَخَادَعْ نَفْسَكَ فِي الْعِبَادَةِ. Try to fool yourself in terms of ibadah. وَرْفِقْ بِهَا وَلَا تَقْهَرْهَا. It's like, imagine you're trying to convince a child to do something. You have to be very gentle and you have to use very cunning ways to get the child to do what you want, because the child is stubborn. The self is not like that child. It just wants to have fun, wants to play. So you need to fool it. You need to trick it. So the Imam says, trick yourself into ibadah and take it easy. Rifq means taking it easy and gentle. وَقَدْ عَفُّهَا وَنَشَاطُهَا. When there are times that the self needs to relax, then let it relax. When times it feels like it's strong and it wants to do things, then do things. وَإِلَّا مَا كَانَ مَكْتُوبٌ عَلَيْكَ مِنَ الْفَرِيضَةِ. If not, just do whatever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted from you to do. Don't overdo it. So with yourself, you can see that at times you feel too weak and too tired and you can't be bothered praying, for example, Salatul Layl or any extra worship. The Imam says, don't do it. Just leave it at that state. And there are times where you see yourself, no, I have energy. Then go for it. Let us take a short break and then we will continue right after.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifah As-Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana.